On this episode, we're doing something a little different. Since we are rapidly approaching the end of 2025, and therefore approaching the end of celebrating movies released in years ending in five, today we'll be doing something new and slightly chaotic that we've invented, the lightning round. I will be setting a timer for 15 minutes and will rapid fire thoughts about five movies that didn't get full episodes this year. Helping me with this task today is my co-host here at Movieversaries and the man who created this concept with me, Andy Williams, and my bestie that I love causing chaos with, Craig McKenzie. I'm Violet Hammond, and this is Movieversaries, the lightning round. Yes, this is Movieversaries, and I am your host today, Violet Hammond. And this is where we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. But as you've just heard, today we are doing something a little different. And for the first section of this lightning round, with me today is Andy Williams. Andy, thanks for joining me for this.
Thanks very much for squeezing me in to get just these final few movies out that we didn't get a chance to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's super exciting. I am very happy that we're going to do this, and fingers crossed that this concept is proved today. Proof of concept in the STEM way. So for our first lightning round, we will be discussing Teen Wolf, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. It was released in 1985. And since this was your pick and peek behind the curtain, you gave this movie up for our Christmas special.
I did.
You did, but...
Which one is more worthy?
Oh,
a Charlie Brown Christmas or Teen Wolf?
I mean, I think I'm going to have to throw my vote towards Charlie Brown Christmas. However, it was really fun to revisit this, I will say. It was super fun. So our lightning round for Teen Wolf starts now. So, Andy, why is Teen Wolf great?
Oh, is it? That's the other question.
Or if it is, yes.
It's just so camp. It's so ridiculous. It doesn't quote unquote hold up in the traditional sense or any kind of tonal sense, but it's just a vibe, right? It's just a vibe of the 80s in small town America where Marty McFly, pre-Marty McFly, turns into a wolf because reasons.
Like super duper so close, Marty McFly. This movie lost to Back to the Future.
Rightfully
so. At the box office. Oh, completely rightfully so. But it's amazing to me that these two movies were out at the same time. That's wild.
Well, there was a break in production of Family Ties when Michael J. Fox was playing Alex P. Keaton. And that was like the end of the season. So during his off season, he went off and made Teen Wolf and then had to, we talked about it on the episode, squeeze in Back to the Future around Family Ties. And I think it ultimately worked out for the best, but I think time being done again, I'm not sure that would be exactly what would happen.
Well, I will say I'm glad that he wasn't making himself sick filming two things at once for Teen Wolf. I'm glad that it was for Back to the Future.
Yeah, that was a much more worthy project.
Yes. Not that this doesn't have its charms. I mean, I will say it's nice to see an 80s teen comedy that doesn't have an assault scene. It does have a moment of homophobia.
It does have a moment. It does have like massively outdated gender politics.
Oh, very much so. Yes.
And females are the prize. It's the 80s teen comedy. That's how it works. If you become the wolf, then you become liked by females, shall we say.
There's that, yeah.
Then that one scene.
That one scene is confounding. And it's funny, whenever I go back to these things, I'm like, I have vivid memories of watching this as a kid. Like, I remember the scene with him on top of the van mm-hmm. with Surfin' USA playing. I remember, like, almost shot for shot as it was playing when I watched it, the final basketball game, the championship yeah. game. I was like, I yeah, remember yeah. watching this. How did I watch this? Like, there's that one scene in particular is not great.
No, that doesn't work. So I remember, right, it didn't happen often, but my parents would occasionally have a night without children. And I went and stayed with my godmother. And this was a film that she had on VHS.
Mm-hmm.
And she had children of a similar age to myself and my sister. And we watched this. So it's kind of burned in from a very young age. It must have been like the first time I heard The Beach Boys, for example.
Mm, yeah.
I think I blocked out the whole, you know,
mm-hmm.
strange theater-related scene. But I have absolute vivid memories of give me a keg
yes.
of beer.
Yes. That part was so silly.
Yes.
And it's very funny to have seen this, and I forgot that, like, Styles is a character in this, because once Teen Wolf, the TV show, the much more dramatic version of this story that made a lot of changes, became popular, I feel like I forgot almost everything that was in the 80s movie I watched when I was a kid. So
I never watched the series.
Okay.
So, I mean, how does it compare generally?
Very different as far as characters go, because it has much different lore. It's like a different town. Scott has a different last name. Like,
is it literally just concept? A teenager who is a wolf?
No, there's like family lore, kind of like in the same way that this is, oh, I was hoping it would skip a generation, son, but you're a werewolf too. Ha ha. Meanwhile, the dad is like the sweetest, nicest, greatest character. He's such a lovely character. But this, you know, in the movie, but in the TV show, it was very much like in that vein of drama, like Dawson's Creek kind of
yes.
like teen. This
it was
is the
like
end
True
of the
Bloody
thing.
Era, wasn't it? It was that. It,
yes. Where there were a lot of supernatural soap operas, shall we say. That's more yes. of what it like felt like. And Styles was a character, but it's his best friend, but was not as wild or silly or chaotic as he is in this movie.
Deeply problematic or
super super problematic. Yes. Drive my car without a license, I'm going to be standing on top of this van. Yes.
Yeah. It's he's a vibe.
Definitely a vibe.
I'm not sure one that I would personally get on with, but hey. Sorry, what was the next question? We've divulged already, and there was...
We've jumped through, but it's fine. We still have 9 minutes and 22 seconds left, see? And
excellent.
We didn't know if this concept was going to work. So far, it's working, guys. Don't worry.
It's working.
So, yeah, the next thing on our lightning round is, what's your favorite? So, what's your favorite? Do you have a favorite moment, favorite character? I have one.
Okay, it's definitely give me a keg of beer. Like, that is just unhinged. But...
Oh, yeah. the red eyes.
Like, this is so, so bad. But that final basketball sequence is... It's enduring. Like, it's great, because he's actively choosing to not be the wolf, and he's choosing to be Scott. And you can become very sanctimonious about the message of 80s movies, and being yourself is ultimately better. Whatever, but... You know, having that final scene where he's got to make two free throws to win the game.
Yeah.
As a concept, it works. That's why basketball as a sport works. That's why it's been used so many times in many different films and many different TV shows. So I do love both that and the first sort of full reveal of the wolf at the school dance.
Yes.
What about you?
Well, I mean, my favorite is definitely also that last championship basketball game. It is great.
Excellent.
And yes, it is very by the numbers in terms of 80s coming of age. But you and I both love coming of age movies. We've talked about it before. So
we do.
this is, it has a supernatural concept of how can you grow up but also be more true to yourself. So with all of that going on and how he does indeed actively choose not to be the wolf for that final game and to win that game and play as a team with his friends is, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that it's like powerful, but it's, you know, it's a nice lesson.
Yeah,
and I enjoy it.
He gives them a chance to take shots and they have their moments as well. Yeah, it works.
Yeah, it's cute. It's a fun movie. I have not seen it in a very long time. I had a nice time revisiting it. It does have those 80s issues that we discussed with other movies that we've covered on this show. So, you know, you have that, but Michael J. Fox is charming as always. God, such a charming, charismatic performer, for real. I don't know if this movie works with anyone other than him.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. He's,
yeah,
there's that moment when he's in the bathroom and he's beginning to try and figure out what's going on. And that's when you get the only hint of Marty McFly, because Marty's kind of upper register in vocally from where Michael J. Fox is. And you can hear him coming out in the exasperation when he's trying to tell his dad that he needs,
I can't open the door now. Yeah, all of that is very silly, but very funny. And then when the door opens and his dad is there, like, full wolf as well.
The fact that there's no reveal to that is literally just, he opens the door and it's just, he's there, full wolf.
Yeah, just there.
Yep.
And he doesn't have gray hair when he's his dad, but he's all gray when he's the wolf. So gray silly, wolf.
Yep.
But fun. Yes. We're in favorites. It's not a shortcoming, but I thought that the whole, like, vice principal and dad subplot was a little silly.
Oh,
that wasn't necessary. Oh, we didn't need it.
That is kind of the, I mean, there's a couple of problems with the film, but one of the major ones is that the humor does skewer quite young. And the idea that the vice principal pees himself, specifically when he sees that the dad is the wolf.
The dad wolf.
You just, yeah, okay, that's skewering young again. It's, you know,
yeah,
bodily functions are funny.
It's like, kids find this funny. Yeah, exactly. Here we go. We're approaching 5 minutes left in our lightning round for Teen Wolf. So, Andy, is there an MVP for Teen Wolf?
You've already hit on it. It's Michael J. Fox.
It's Michael J. Fox, yeah. 1,000%.
This film gets lost to the annals of time were it not for Michael J. Fox. However, I do want to shout out Jeff Loeb. Jeff Loeb, the writer. He went on to write many of the great Batman stories, and he did some really good work for Marvel as well. He did a great Daredevil story and a great Captain America story, and he's one of the most celebrated comic book writers, and he wrote both this and Commando, so. he had a register in the 80s. That was his thing. I do want to shout him out, but absolutely, the film doesn't work without Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, he is 100% the MVP. I mean, what a year for him, honestly. 1985, like, between Back to the Future and, like, this to a lesser extent, and he was huge on TV with Family Ties. Like, he was a huge star.
I recently read a book that he wrote about the time that he was filming Back to the Future, and he said about Teen Wolf in the book that he thought that was his shot. That was the one chance where he was going to move into movies, to graduate into movies, because that's what you did in those days. It wasn't seen as television being at a level with film. So Teen Wolf was his graduation from Family Ties into movies, and let's just say, thank God Back to the Future came along.
Yes. I mean, and with everything, with how that started too, which, like, go back and listen to our episode on that one, guys, because it wasn't supposed to be him, but I think most people know that story. But still, it's, what a year.
What a great year.
Michael J. Fox, 1985. We are just under 3 minutes left in our lightning round. Andy, in 10 years, does Teen Wolf deserve a full episode?
Absolutely not.
I was going to say, if you said yes.
That's not an argument I'm going to have.
No.
It's the reason I seeded it for Charlie Brown Christmas is that we did about an hour and a quarter on a 28-minute special versus 15 minutes kind of about covers Teen Wolf.
It does. Yeah, we definitely, I agree. This movie does not need a full episode, but I think definitely in the context of other things we've talked about this year, Back to the Future in particular.
And The Breakfast Club and teen 80s comedies. And
yeah, this ties into a lot of the things that we've already discussed in more detail this year. You can find all those episodes in your feed. And like, I think that it's definitely something that was worth mentioning for a 15-minute lightning round.
Absolutely.
All right. I mean, I think we've wrapped it up. We actually did it in less than 15. We're at a minute 49 left. Oh. So I'm ready to move on if you are.
We're
ready
on a roll.
For our next lightning round. I know. All right. So, everyone, the next movie on our lightning round is Clue, which is also 1985. It's also the 40th anniversary of this movie. And the Clue lightning round begins now. So Clue's here because when we were doing Rocky Horror, yes, when we recorded our Rocky Horror episode, I said, oh, you know what? We have to talk about Clue. What year did that come out? And when I saw 85, like, my heart sank. Like, yes. There's just no time to do it this year. But we figured it out.
Just about. Just yes. About. So then the question is to you, Violet, because I've covered this film on Frame to Frame with Sean.
Yes, you did.
But what makes it great, if it is?
It is great. Clue is a great, great, great movie. It's definitely one of my very favorites. We called out Tim Curry for his unbelievable performance on the Rocky Horror episode, but you and I both agreed that Clue is probably his actual best performance. And I've been thinking about it since we recorded Rocky Horror, and I think that it's still absolutely true. I think Clue, as Wadsworth, is his finest screen performance. It's unreal. Besides,
you mean
that,
you like it when he buttles?
I buttle, sir. Yeah. The way he ties that whole thing together is unbelievable. And we talked about it on Rocky Horror. Like, he's so charismatic. He's so charming. He's unbelievable. When he switches in those, which if you haven't seen Clue, spoiler alert, there's three separate endings. So when he's
now there is
now, yeah, there's three separate endings. When he is in each of those endings, it's just so real and believable for the two where he is the hero and for the one where he is the villain. Like, it's believable in all three. But the other things that make it great, obviously, the script is amazing. It's written so tightly, so amazing. There's only one ad lib in that movie. Everything else is scripted.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. What's the ad lib?
Flames on the side of my face. Breathing. Heaving breaths. Yes. The great Madeline Kahn is the only person who escaped with an ad lib. Because how do you cut that?
I was noting down favorite lines. And the first one that came up was Flames.
On the side of my face. That was an ad lib. It's the only one. Everything else in there is scripted.
I did not know. That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I guess we've got to shout out John Landis, whose Spectre held large over the previous movie, over Teen Wolf.
Yeah.
However, in this, he did the story, and Jonathan Lynn directed, wrote the screenplay, and also did the story. Jonathan Lynn knew Tim Curry from back in their theatre days.
Yes.
Because, you know, obviously. And that was what led to the casting in this. So, I'm glad we get to discuss it.
Yes.
Even very quickly.
Quickly enough.
Quickly enough. So, the cast notwithstanding.
Yes.
What else is it that really rewards its repeat viewing?
Oh, yes, because this is such a great repeat viewing. And as you and I have also discussed, it still plays great for kids. like great for kids. My kids have loved this movie from very young, and it's still one of our favorites. Like, this is, you can throw this on and you recite the whole movie, but it's just still so much fun.
I can attest personal experience. This movie, I put it on this year. Both of my children watched it, and they now call it the murder movie.
Yep, which is brilliant. Which is,
yes, because Clue isn't over here. It's called Cluedo for a start. Yes,
I know.
But which is weird. But we've not played the game. But my youngest, being the person that she is, she loves a good murdery thing, and this is appropriate. So
it is, because it makes it. I mean, murder's not funny. Like,
we'll put that
right out there. It's not. But this movie is very funny, and it's not in any.
This movie exists in a register that it's heightened and it's separate, because the jokes are so dense, and the setting is so specific, and it takes a lot of those classic horror tropes and subverts them for an absurdist yet comedic effect.
Yes. Oh, it's completely silly. It's another great camp movie. This is another excellent example of complete and utter campiness. And
what is it with you and I and campness?
I know.
I have no idea.
I don't know. Things that are inherently theatrical. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like that.
By that you mean fabulous.
Oh, 100%. Yes. They exist in this space. Yeah. Every single person on this screen in this movie, I would say this is probably one of their best performances.
Yes.
Like, definitely.
Agreed.
Everyone, every single person in this movie. And
except maybe for Christopher Lloyd.
I don't know. He's so, like, he
he's
has.
He's great in it, but he's got great. So many other great performances.
Yeah. But he is. The funny thing is that it took my son a really long time to realize that this was Doc Brown.
Really?
Yeah. Because they do. The two characters do look very different. But when he realized that it was the same guy, that really blew his mind.
My kids picked up on that.
Really?
Yeah. It might have helped that we'd gone to see Back to the Future in the cinema relatively close to when we watched Clue. But
yeah, I mean, I feel like he's probably seen both movies from a very early age. But yeah, that realization was, well, wait, that's the same guy. I'm like, it sure is the same guy. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Here's a gold star.
Sure is. Yeah, he's, all the characters are so, like, perfectly drawn and just fun. And for someone who did grow up playing that board game, and I'm pretty good at that game, not to, you know, toot my own horn or anything, but I'm pretty good at it. Like, it is
you figuring out clues and getting to the right answer. No,
but it, like, that is a game that I always loved to play with my Nana. That was one of the games that we played a lot, so I have that kind of built-in memories toward it. And also, it is so fun to see characters that really were just those little playing pieces and then just fully realized and just, like, in the best perfect way. Mm-hmm. And how, God, how funny it is. This movie truly is still laugh out loud funny.
Yes. Yes. Agreed. It brings us nicely to, do you have a favorite moment, line, scene, character? You've got to pick just one.
if I have to pick just one, I am going to give it right now to Tim Curry when Mr. Green tells him there's no need to shout. And he's, I'm not shouting. All right, I am. I'm shout. And then the candlestick falls on his head and he falls down and they all just stand there and watch him on the floor. That's never not funny.
That is the scene that I've quoted the most.
I'm not shouting
to my children. Yeah, okay, I am shouting.
Yeah, if I have to pick just one.
Yes, yeah,
I'm gonna say that right now. What about you?
Okay, I'm gonna cheat and say the entire monologue at the end.
Communism was just a red herring.
I'm actually gonna cheat and just pick as a character Wadsworth.
Yes,
he's a brilliant, like, the fact he has to tie it all together.
Yeah,
when he's working for Mr. Body. Yeah, get it.
Yeah, Mr. Body, everybody.
Yeah, it's all there on the screen.
Yep, it's all there.
His I mean, we'll come to performance, I'm sure, in a second or two.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that he has to know more than everybody, but not let on too much, that the balance that Wadsworth has to bring, whilst the whole time bottling and being proper,
mm-hmm.
it's a testament to the character, the writing, and the performance.
Yes, 1,000%, which I'm assuming, as we're approaching just about 5 minutes, leads us to MVP.
I mean, I'm assuming so.
It's Tim Curry. It's Tim Curry. It's Tim Curry.
Yeah.
Please, it's Tim Curry. Yeah, this is his greatest performance. He holds the whole thing together, and he holds the whole thing together with a cast of powerhouses. You know, it's 85. I'm not really sure where all of these people were in their career, but I have a feeling he probably wasn't the most famous person in this cast. And
no, he'd gone back to theater after Rocky Horror.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a 10-year gap on his
mm-hmm.
film CV between Rocky Horror and Clue.
Yeah.
Because he just, that wasn't where he was. Like, I'm not dismissing what he'd done.
Yes.
He was in Amadeus.
Like,
he was in Pirates of Penzance. Like, he'd done some great things. He wasn't so much a film actor at that point.
And then we were back with a vengeance. I mean, it is.
He knew we were waiting with sweet anticipation.
We needed him back. Yeah, I mean, unlike Teen Wolf, which was a box office success, this was not. And it
insanity.
Is, yeah. Oh, I
know. Utter insanity. It's this way around.
Oh, I know. Crazy, right? But this is just like Rocky Horror is another one of those great cult classics where it grew in home viewing and people began to love the fact that it had three different endings and you can watch them all at home as opposed to not knowing which ending you were going to get when you went to the theater. So mm-hmm. it is just an amazing experiment that failed at the box office but succeeded in everyone's hearts. Like, I'm constantly hearing that this is people's favorite movie, and for good reason. It's a great, great movie.
Yes, it is. So the final question to you then, Violet, does it deserve a full episode in 10 years time?
Yeah, I think in 10 years we should really have a Clue breakdown. I really do. I'm so glad we did a lightning round this year, but I think we have a date in 10 years to talk about Clue on its 50th anniversary.
Don't. Oh, God, you've made me feel old.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with you. It does deserve a full episode. You know, like I said, we've already covered it on Frame to Frame, but I'm more than happy to jump back in and chat with all of the panel about Clue. There's so much more to dive into.
I love it. Yes. It's a date. All right.
It's a date.
Once again, I'm giving you some time back because we're good. We still have like 2 minutes left, but I think we covered it. I think this is good.
We are on top of this. We are. Who said that we need to make podcasts longer than the films? Not this guy.
No.
We're going straight through.
Not us. We're excellent at lightning rounds. We majored in lightning rounds, just like Chandler. All right. Well, for our third film in our lightning rounds, this one was my pick. And it's
yes,
this is 2005 Pride and Prejudice on its 20th anniversary, which is madness.
It is for you, I guess, but I never watched it at the time.
Oh, was this a first time watch for you?
It was, yeah, yeah.
Are you serious?
No, so contextually, I was 14 when it came out.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, a 14-year-old boy isn't the primary target audience for a costume drama. And I was also already familiar with the Colin Firth TV series.
Wow. Yeah, that is.
So I went, that's fine. Like, I've kind of seen this.
Like, I've seen this, exactly. So as a 14-year-old boy, you were not going to get into it. I'm going to tell my story, but I'm going to say right now that the Pride and Prejudice lightning round starts now. So to get back to the BBC series, yes, I couldn't tell you how many times I've read this book. so many times. I've seen that BBC series, I don't even want to tell you how many times. Circling back to the Barbie episode of Academy Watch, when Greta Gerwig called me out personally, like pointed out the screen at me sitting in my seat with my popcorn and said,
she did that to my wife too.
Depression Barbie lays on the couch and watches all 5 hours of the BBC Pride and Prejudice of Colin Firth. And my daughter's head like snapped to me and I said, don't say a word. Like, do not say, it's like, do not say a word. She's like, I can't believe that's in this movie. I said, oh, I'm just as shocked as you, but do not say a word. Yeah, I have so much love for the book. I have so much love for that series. And I also was very much like, I don't need this. Why do I need this? And then my mom made me watch it. And
go, Mom.
I thought that this was the most beautiful film I had ever seen. It is filmed so beautifully. I'm not going to bring up my example because it's my favorite part. So when we get to that, I will tell you. But
okay,
it's filmed beautifully. The characters are drawn so nicely. It's a really good telling of the story in a short amount of time. How did it play for you?
So it strips away basically everything that isn't about Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy, and it kind of streamlines it. That's how you tell this story. That's kind of the only way you could tell this story in this shorter amount of time. I've never read the book.
Okay.
I've only seen the old TV series. You know what? It played really, really well. I was really impressed. I mean, you can see, I'd seen Atonement when it came out because I'd come out of being 14. By that point, I was the grand old age of 16 and therefore more mature.
Yeah, exactly.
Watching Atonement. And we'll say nothing about Pan, which the director did later. But he has a real eye for building worlds and the way that he manages to take inspiration from people like David Lean. You can tell that he's modeling off of sort of classical paintings rather than looking to just fill the frame with whatever he needs to film the frame with. Yeah, it played really well. The question I've got for you, though, what is it that makes it great? Is there just that one thing that makes it great?
If I had to pick one thing, I'd say Keira Knightley. I think she makes it great. I think she's a perfect Elizabeth. And that was difficult for me because I didn't think I was going to find a more perfect Elizabeth. But I think that what she says with her eyes and her expressions in this, not to mention the fact that she is just perfectly saying all of this dialogue that I know so well from having read it so many times, I feel like it has to be her. She is just completely embodying this character. And it's gorgeous. It's, you know, it's filmed gorgeously. And like, we're seeing her. This is not the one I'm going to mention, but when she does go on holiday with her family and she's standing on those rocks and like the wind is blowing her dress, and it's like, oh my God, like it is achingly beautiful.
Yes. England has almost never looked this good. Lizzie is a feminist icon. She is such a key character in the history of literature. And the way that Austin wrote her, bear in mind, like I've never read the book, but like I've done the Austin Museum in Bath. I'm familiar enough, I think. And the way that Austin represented sort of Regency England, where one has to marry, and if you're not married by 28, you're basically an old maid. The way that Keira Knightley plays that and plays her seniority over her sisters,
yes,
it's brilliant. Especially when you consider at the time she was what, 19, 20?
Yeah.
She was a great actress at a really young age.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. And this is not, Pride and Prejudice doesn't have the heartbreak of that situation that something like Sense and Sensibility does, which was released in a year ending in 6. So get ready.
It was.
Yeah, but like Sense and Sensibility really reaches into the heartbreak of that and the loneliness of that situation at this time and the like helplessness of the that situation for this time. But Pride and Prejudice, while it does have so much to do with that you have to find a husband and what that does to you as a person, it has a lot more to do with how Darcy and Elizabeth first meet and then how for the rest of the book they are tearing down the misconceptions they have about each other.
Mm.
And it
Darcy's a dick
at the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, even yeah. At the end, I don't think he changes.
I think that he changes to a certain extent. I think it's not that he changes. I think that he
we learn more about him, but he's still quite frosty. He's still got that demeanor about him.
Yeah.
It's just that we were more aware of what he does behind the scenes.
We're aware of what he does behind the scenes, but he learns how to communicate. I think a lot of the issues in the beginning is that he just does not know how to communicate with people. And it feels this way in the book, too. Like, he legitimately does do all of these. It's not outside the realm of reality to say heroic things. For at this time, he does save this family. Like, if what happens to Lydia had been allowed to continue without the steps he took to fix it, they would have been, like, thrown out of society. It would have been terrible. Now, in the end, he is also doing this so that he can still marry Lizzie, because he can't marry her if the family is in ruins. So he is doing it for his own benefit in a way.
Yeah.
But it is still heroic, and he does take along the whole family and save them in that. And he does it, and we're happy he does it. But I think he just, at the beginning, he's just a dick. It's true. But he just doesn't know how to talk to people. He's probably, neurodivergent.
That wasn't a thing. We just overdiagnose everything now, apparently.
That wasn't true.
No, that was just... neurodivergence didn't exist before the 1990s anyway, so it's whatever.
That's true. Totally.
Obviously. That's what we all know.
Clearly.
Matthew McFadden, then.
Yes.
Unknown actor at the time. Mm-hmm. Only able to be cast because of Keira Knightley's star power, because you've got the star in Elizabeth, but then the non-star as Darcy.
Mm-hmm.
How is he as your Darcy?
I love him in this movie, and I didn't think anything could ever replace. I don't want to say replace. They're both good.
Yeah, he's no Colin Firth.
He's not Colin Firth, but it's fine because I really like how he plays the part. I can see more growth in him than I do in Colin Firth. Colin Firth is a dick the whole way through. It is true. I mean, I love him, but he is. But he softens in this movie. He does. And it's helped by Keira Knightley's performance, too.
I agree. And I think that what helps is, like, I don't mean this in a bad way, but Colin Firth is just in that film oozingly, or in the TV series, oozingly handsome.
Oh my god, yeah, I know.
And I mean, that's an awakening for a generation of people. And Matthew McFadden isn't that.
No, he isn't.
But he does have something.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the microcosm as to how he's different, in that he's got possibly a bit more about his performance.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so moment then.
Yeah. Here we go.
Moment, lines, characters, but moment.
Mr. Bennett is always a superstar on the stage and on the screen, and this movie doesn't disappoint.
I wonder if we've got the same moment.
No, my favorite moment is an example of how absolutely beautifully shot this movie is. And it's when Darcy is walking toward her at the very end of the movie as the sun is rising and like the mist is coming up from the grass and that music, that scene is perfection.
If you'd have put alternate music on that though, it would have looked like he was on a mission to kill her.
It's
a very different movie with a horror score.
Oh my god. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. But however, it's that beautiful orchestral. Like it really is. That scene is breathtaking.
So Dario Marinelli, the composer, uses a great deal of restraint across the film. He avoids the melodrama and lets the emotion accentuate itself quite slowly across the course of the whole film. However, it's that moment where he is allowed to, or he allows himself to really swell and grow and fill the screen. And that is the moment where we're swept off our feet by the score.
Yeah.
It waits for us to be ready for that. And by God, it earns it. My moment, however, is when Donald Sutherland, as Mr. Bennett, says, pulls the rug underneath and says, if you do marry him, then I'm done with you. Yep. When Elizabeth has got the choice to make as to whether she's going to marry Mr. Collins or not. And her mother is pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing.
Which is what she does. As played by
the great Brenda Blethyn. She's kind of trying to manipulate the situation. Yeah. And then for Donald Sutherland to read the room and give Elizabeth that agency. Yeah, I think that moment was just one of those fist punch in the air. Yes, go on.
He's like, again, rock star on the page and in every version. Mr. Bennett is unbelievable. One of your parents will not speak to you anymore after today. Your mother will not speak to you if you don't, and I will not speak to you if you do. And it's just like, and her face, Keira Knightley's face is like, dad's on my side. Well. Yeah. Yeah, that scene
Daddy's little girl.
Fantastic.
It's a great performance from him. Like the moment at the end as well, where you've got the sort of close up where they're looking at each other and you can see the for lack of a better word, pride in his face. Mm-hmm. And it feels, for a very small character in the film, he brings a lot of heart to it, and there's a real fatherly presence to his performance. So it's that moment for me.
I love it. We're coming up on 1 minute left in the lightning round. This is the one we needed all 15 minutes.
Oh dear. MVP.
Keira Knightley.
Okay. Dario Marinelli for me.
Good. I love it. And then I think I know the answer to this one.
Does it deserve a full episode?
Oh, I'll see you in 10 years, honey. I'll see you in 10 years for the 30th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice. It needs a full episode to really dig into all of the reasons why this movie is great with a capital G, for sure.
Yes.
And I hope the rest of our panel wants to join us for that one, because...
Yes, I hope so too.
I love this movie, and I didn't think I would.
Yes, I did too. And bear in mind, I watched it for the first time 24 hours ago.
I can't believe that. I'm so glad that you did. Thanks.
Yeah. It's what we have to do for the lightning round. We've got to squeeze things in quickly.
We are. We're getting it done before the end of the year. And speaking of getting it done, we're down to our last 10 seconds of the Pride and Prejudice lightning round. Final thought?
I will see you in 10 years, my friend.
See you in 10 years. Our first lightning round is complete, and now it's time to welcome my guest for round two. You know him from Neil Before Blog, and you've heard him on Movieversaries this year for Back to the Future and Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the movie. It's Craig McKenzie. Hi.
Hello. I'm glad to be back. And I'm glad you're having me back after forcing everyone to watch Power Rangers.
No, you know that Ian and I had a great time. That was so much fun. We still need to set up the drinking game. I'll watch it again with a drinking game. On your list of movies for this year, there were two that we didn't get to specifically. I think there were others, but there were two that you really wanted to talk about that we didn't get to. So when Andy and I came up with this lightning round concept, I thought of you. Both of your movies came out in 2015, so they're both celebrating their 10th anniversary this year. They are The Martian and Jurassic World. Mm-hmm. Which one do you want to start with? Because I know one of these conversations is going to go one way and one of these conversations is going to go the other way. So what do you want to do first?
I think get Jurassic World out of the way. Get that out the road.
I love it. So I'm going to start the timer and then I'll ask you your first question because this is like a game show. Just think of it like a game show. And the lightning round for Jurassic World starts now. So is this movie great? And if so, what makes it great? And if it's not great, I can't wait to hear you talk about it.
No, it's not great at all. I really hate this movie. And I actually thought it would be an interesting one to talk about at length because in a lot of ways it's, I don't know if it's an early example of this hellscape that we live in now that's just nostalgia-driven, but the reason it's not great is because all it made me do is want to watch the original Jurassic Park. Mm. Because all it did was call back to it. Here's the big door, here's the Gallimimus herd, here's the, you know, well, the T-Rex again, and so on.
Yeah.
It basically it just does what the original movie does, but worse. And it had such an interesting idea of this, the park is open, it's this commercial enterprise, and it basically should have been, you know, velociraptors eating people in the queue for Burger King and stuff like that. They should have went full B-movie with it.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Like, I could totally get behind that. You know, I love these movies. I love Jurassic Park, Jurassic World. Like, even when they're bad, I enjoy a bad movie watch. I know you do, too, in a different way. But I know that this makes you mad for all of the reasons that you've brought up. Yeah. This is... It's something I enjoyed when I saw it, but I definitely know that it is soulless. It feels like a, yes, it is like a soulless piece of blockbuster movie making.
Yeah.
That, yeah.
There's only one decent death in it. The assistant Katie McGrath's character, when she gets lifted by a flying dinosaur and thrown into the mouth of the water one.
Yes. Oh, and I feel like they gave that away in the trailer, too. You knew that was coming.
Yeah.
Because I remember thinking, like, okay, well, this is coming at some point because we saw it in the trailer. But, yeah, that part is brutal.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
This poor put-upon assistant who's just harangued for the entire movie.
Correct. It is pretty insane. I forgot that was her, too. Wow. But, yeah.
Lena Luthor.
Oh. Yeah, I forgot that was her. Yeah, I mean, it had like a crazy cast. Like, I love Bryce Dallas Howard in pretty much everything. I don't hate her in this, but the entire story became how she could run in heels. So,
yes.
Yay, yeah. Feminism.
And they make a joke about it in the second one where she's wearing more sensible shoes for running away from dinosaurs.
She came prepared. The second one's
better.
Time.
The next one's better.
Yes, I know you like the next one more, and the third one you think is complete insanity.
The third one's horrible. Yeah, it's the worst. It's the culmination of how bad these films can get, I think, that third one.
Oh, lordy. Well, considering how you feel about this movie, do you have any favorite moments or lines or scenes or characters, or is everything least favorite?
I just told you the favorite
the
bit,
one
I guess.
Good one. Yeah.
Yeah, the one, I think it's, is it just the one death in the movie? Is it the only person who dies?
Well, maybe. You kind of get when the flying dinosaurs are going over all the people running away over what's kind of like the Main Street USA part of the park. It yeah. feels like a lot of people are dying, but you don't really. It's kind of like bloodless. You don't really see anything. It's not like with Jurassic Park. There, you knew that things were getting really bad when they got bad.
And yeah, there's no sense of terror in it, really. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't feel that at all. It feels, it's a movie about a theme park that feels like a theme park. It doesn't feel, it feels like you're very removed from what should be a terrifying situation. There's no real tangible feeling of anything in this. It is a product. This movie is a product.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and it doesn't get away with it by pretending to satirize that in some way where it's, oh yeah, it's the... What's it, the mobile phone company owns the Indominus Rex or whatever.
Yes.
It's all corporate sponsorship and all this nonsense.
Yeah, it's sponsored. And it's like, well,
that's what this movie is, though. Like, you can't really call it out because that's what you're doing. Yeah, it just doesn't get to call out the fact that it's anti-capitalist because it is completely capitalist. So oh. it doesn't get away with it.
No. I love that point. Well, I mean, even though I can recognize that this movie is soulless, as we've said, I have to say my favorite part is when the T-Rex comes out at the end. But that's just because I love the T-Rex. I loved the T-Rex from the first movie. And I was like, they completely emotionally blackmailed me by saying it's the same T-Rex and having the same scars on it from the fight with the velociraptors at the end of the movie. I realize and recognize that I'm being taken advantage of, but I still love when the T-Rex comes out and she's running away with the flare. Like, sure. Okay. Am I ashamed of it? Maybe a little bit, but I liked that part. I was happy. I had my popcorn. She was running in heels away from my girl, the T-Rex.
The Velociraptor training sequence, that's okay. I think that's quite well done.
Yeah. And it's funny to look at this now and think about how differently we felt about Chris Pratt 10 years ago than we do now. Like, he is just like an internet whipping boy at this point and has been for maybe the last 5 years. But at this point in his career, it felt like there was no stopping him.
Yeah, he was very much trying to fit into this action guy mold when he was more of a funny guy before that. I think it's Zero Dark Thirty where he starts to fall into that. I don't know they ever quite got there, though. I mean, he's in these movies and the Guardians movies, obviously, where he is kind of a mess in those movies, but that's the point. You know, he's sort of this unlikely action guy. And this, I think they lay it on a bit thick because his introduction scene, he's like working on the motorcycle and he's sweating and he's acting all manly. And it's just very, it's very offensive. Like, I'm offended on behalf of my gender watching that scene where it's,
it's a offensive, stereotypical masculinity. Yeah. He's very dismissive of Bryce Dallas Howard. I don't know if that's exactly how you should be speaking to your boss, but okay, he's a cool guy, sure. Like, it is a very odd situation. It's just that's the one thing that came to mind. I was like, wow, we were in a very different world with this actor 10 years ago. He was he had Guardians and he was coming off of Parks and Rec where everybody loved him, and then he has things have changed slightly.
They make fun of that scene in the second one because his introduction in the second one is he's building his own house, so it's I think it is treated with a wink and a nod to that scene.
So they kind of try to fix some of their past transgressions in the second one.
I feel like the second one had more things to say, and some of it was just making fun of this movie, which I approved of,
which is fine. Oh my lord. Well, it does kind of get to a strange moment where there really aren't a lot of favorites. Obviously, is there anything that is your least favorite? What do you dislike the most about this movie?
Just how soulless it is, really. I just think it's constructed in such a way that it's meant to mine your nostalgia for the original Jurassic Park. And obviously it worked because it made $1 billion.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a lot of people that loved it because, it reminded me of Jurassic Park. It's like, but we have Jurassic Park at home. We can watch Jurassic Park whenever we want. We don't need to see someone ape it in rubbish ways. Like, as bad as Jurassic Park 3 is, at least it doesn't try to do any of that. At least it goes its own way.
Yeah.
And The Lost World is kind of more of the same but bigger, and it's still Spielberg, so it's still good.
Yeah.
But it's not as good. And it's just really bad. I really hate that it's trying to mine my love of the first movie rather than finding something to say on its own.
Now, in the context of this coming out, I feel like were we just beginning this whole like terrible cycle we're in of sequels and legacy sequels and all that kind of stuff? Was this one of the first ones that really did it, or were we already kind of entrenched in it? I was trying to think in my head of where we were at this point.
It was like a big example. I can't think of anything before this that really cemented us in this era that we're still in, but this feels like a massive contributor to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it makes lots of money, so they just keep doing it with everything.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'll never forget one of my favorite things you ever wrote was the thing about Illy and Romulus, where he said it's like just dragging the corpse around. Like, this movie literally does feel like we're dragging the corpses of the dinosaurs, like, through the park and just trying to, hey, guys, come and look over here. Isn't this great? Don't you want to give us your money? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Remember that scene that was better than the movie that was done in originally? Remember that? Yes, I do.
I do remember it, actually. I was there. Yes.
Yeah.
Well.
Seen it. And I'm going to go home and watch it after this because I need to cleanse from this experience.
I need some Jurassic Park holy water.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. Well, considering everything you have to say about it, is there even an MVP, or do we want to crown someone who's most responsible for this?
I'll give it to Vincent D'Onofrio. He's not the deepest character by any means, but he's entertaining.
Yeah.
I like that he's just this slimy corporate douchebag that wants to weaponize the dinosaurs and use them to, you know, for military purposes.
You know what? I will agree with you because there's literally no subtext to that character.
None.
Everything about him is just right there, but he's probably the most honest thing in that movie.
Yeah,
that is like, what the government would do. The government would say, this is awesome. Can we get like a laser sight on their eyes and like send them straight out against our enemies? Like absolutely no care at all for the fact that they're living creatures, that they have a right to exist on their own terms. Just, yeah, everything about him is just right there for you to see.
Yeah. But also, velociraptors, probably not going to do much against a machine gun. If you see them coming, then you can get them.
Yeah, you're going to take them right down, 100%. Yeah. For me, I'm going to say that the T-Rex is the MVP because I love the T-Rex.
The original T-Rex.
I love the original T-Rex. She's a queen. Look, she's out there. She's taking on the world. She's doing the best she can. The end, she gets to climb up on top of that building and roar. She won.
She's still around, isn't she? Isn't she? They don't kill her in the third one.
I don't think so. Yeah. No.
She'll be in that preserve that they tear apart in the third one, I guess.
Good. I hope she's getting some well-deserved R&R. I hope she's enjoying her time. She deserves it. It's what she deserves. Speaking of what is deserved, in 10 years, when this is celebrating its 20th anniversary, does Jurassic World deserve a full episode on movieversaries?
I think so. I think there's a lot to unpack here in terms of where it sits in film history and what it did to the movie industry or the contributing factors. And God knows where we'll be in 10 years in terms of that blockbuster output. I imagine we'll have at least another couple of Jurassic World movies by then.
You are unfortunately probably correct. I mean,
because the last one made money, even though it's bad, which is baffling.
The one this year was Jonathan Bailey.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoyed it because of Jonathan Bailey. So once again, I'm not proud. I'm not proud that I'm being very surface level on this, but I did have a good time at that movie. You felt differently. I know.
Yeah, I hate it.
Well, I mean, I would not mind having a full episode on it because I do love when you rant about things. It's very enjoyable.
God, 10 years. I've got plans for 10 years from now.
Oh, Andy and I made plans in round one. You'll hear it when you listen back. We're like, I'll see you in 10 years, buddy, because this is it. This isn't our next chance to do it. And that's why we did the lightning round.
Will podcasting still exist in 10 years?
Sure, it will.
That's a question.
It will. I'll make it. It's definitely going to happen. Well, we have 1 minute and 13 seconds left in our lightning round for Jurassic World. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, just that it's bad.
Just that it's bad. And that's why you wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. You talked about it. And I'll hear more in 10 years, I guess. I'm down. So
I'll mark my calendar now.
Yes, exactly. Put it in there. 10 years from now, December 18th, 2035. That's not a real year.
No.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, we saved the good movie for second. So your second movie for the lightning round, The Martian. Your lightning round starts now. And I know I think this movie is great, but I want to know what makes it great for you.
I think it's unsweeping positivity. It's very infectiously optimistic about science, about discovery, about survival even. It's quite a bleak situation, but it never descends into that melancholy. You know, it's every scene it's like, I've got to solve this problem. Now I've solved this problem. Now the next problem, and so on and so on. I think it's just so propulsive, and it's just so inspiring, and it's so, like I say, infectious in terms of just the way it presents itself. And this was coming at a point where I was really sick of Ridley Scott movies. I was just going to stop watching them because he had a run of really terrible stuff. And then he makes this, and it's like, oh, he's still got it. When he wants to, he's still got it.
Yeah, totally. I remember reading this book and loving this book and then being anxious that it was going to be him and hoping that it was going to be good and being so pleasantly surprised when I saw it at how good it was. And then I do agree with you. It sounds like kind of cheesy to say, but it is such a celebration of the human spirit in a way. Yeah. Like he is, you can make as many jokes about potatoes as you want, but he really does suffer a lot of setbacks and he always picks himself up and keeps going. At work, I have a little phrase I like to use, which is when something goes wrong, let's see if we can make it a problem-tunity. And he had a lot of problem-tunities on this planet beside, you know, when the spaceship thing flies open and he loses all his potatoes. And, like, there's moments in this that are just absolutely heartbreaking when you realize, like, his margin for survival is so very thin that is just devastating when that scene happens. When you feel it coming and you're like, no, don't happen. And it happens like when on a rewatch, because it's a very rewatchable movie too.
Yeah, it like I say, it celebrates, you know, being smart and following scientific method in order to solve problems, which, you know, it celebrates. Yeah, this is how math can save your life. He does the numbers, he figures it out, and then he solves the problem. So It's great. I don't think there's enough science fiction movies that are this excited about the science of it all.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I'm a math nerd and I can figure this out. I'm a plant nerd and I can figure this out and I can survive. And the story that's happening on Earth at the same time is just as compelling as what's happening on Mars with Watney trying to survive. And I've always really enjoyed when people decide not to follow the orders and we're gonna do what we need to do to save this guy. And it has nothing to do with like one person not being important enough. Like he is important enough for all of this. It's very inspiring.
Yeah. It even doesn't tap into the public are upset at how much money we're spending to save one person. It just doesn't come up. It would have been something that anybody following it would have brought up, I think. But it doesn't. It just leaves it. And yeah, you can ignore the fact that there's money being spent.
Yeah. No. And I mean, all of those scenes, I mean, we're okay. So I'm not going to ask you your favorite yet, but I will just hit this right now. But yeah, like just the feeling of an entire globe being brought together and everyone watching when they're trying to rescue him and get him on the ship at the end. And it's like, again, it could be something cheesy, but it really doesn't feel cheesy. It feels so sincere and amazing. And it's good to feel that way sometimes about your, like, about humanity, about our fellow man and women and children standing around and just hoping against hope that they can save this one person. It's beautiful. It really is. I mean, I was nervous about Ridley Scott, but he did a great job on this movie.
Oh yeah, well, regardless of the quality of the movies he's making, there's no doubt that he's a competent director, or more than competent director, one of the greats. So he really brings it in this. I think the way that it plays out and the way it's constructed is excellent.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm ordinarily that person that's like, well, in the book it was bad, but I think that the cuts they made from the book to the screen were to the story's benefit.
Yeah.
Like, because I know you read the book too, for spoilers for the book, but when he's
did read the book,
when he's heading to the launch site toward the end, and then he gets stuck in that horrible like sandstorm. I was like, I can't read like 20 more pages of this. Like, we have been struggling with a capital S. Like, please, can he just get there? Can it? I don't need one more problem. And I appreciate the fact that they didn't give us that one more problem. We just see him head toward the launch site. And I do want to ask, before we get into favorites, though, do want to ask your opinion on it. It's a joke in the book about him becoming Iron Man and cutting a hole in the suit. That's not how it happens in the book. How do you feel that that's what they did in the movie? Were you for or against?
No, it was fine. Yeah, I think it worked pretty well. I like how it's, yeah, I can cut a hole in the suit and then use the atmosphere, the air to thrust it out. And it's like, and I get to fly around like Iron Man. I thought it was,
yeah. Okay, so you're for it. Yeah. I've talked to some people who think that it was dumb, but I liked that. So. But then again, I am easily pleased.
It's a little bit incongruous with the careful science of every other part of the movie. And then it's, yeah, we'll just wing it. I'll just propel myself in a general direction and hope for the best.
We're going to hope for the best. I mean, they do at that point really make it seem like this is the last thing we can do to make this happen. So you do at least feel like the high stakes of that. So that is fine.
Yeah.
Okay. So before I start talking in other ways about how I love this movie, what is your favorite moment or line or scene or character?
I will give a shout out to when they call a meeting, the Council of Elrond, and Sean Bean's in there. I think that's very funny.
Uh-huh. That always made me giggle.
Yeah, I love the montage of him just getting around growing the potatoes at the start, where he's just setting everything up and he blows himself up and all this stuff. He's like, I forgot to calculate the air I was exhaling because I'm stupid. And then, but the way he goes along, figuring it out, planning everything, and all the little interludes where he's raiding his colleagues' stuff, you know, watching Happy Days and listening to disco music.
Yes, being cranky about disco, all of that is very funny. I do love that. As far as, I think my favorite part is probably the rescue, but that seems so pedestrian to say, but because it's just so exciting and you've been like waiting, you've been so tense the whole time that is this going to happen? Is it going to work? And it's that triumphant feeling when they're able to get him. This is an early Sebastian Stan performance. You know how much I love him.
It's a bit of a Marvel summit in this movie.
Yes.
Not all MCU, because you have Kate Mara there as well.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the same year, that awful Fantastic Four movie.
Oh, gosh. That's 10 years old, too. That's insane. Oof. Fan-four-stick. But, yeah, this is just an amazing story, told so well with so many great actors in it.
Yeah.
So many great actors. What an ensemble cast here. Everyone is just at the top of their game. It looks amazing. The cinematography for the Mars shots is unreal. It looks so, so very good. Favorite character? I guess it has to be Watney, right? I mean, so much of this, like half of it is an ensemble drama that feels like a cousin of All the President's Men, with the way everybody's running around and telling half-truths, et cetera, about things. And then the other half is just Matt Damon on Mars.
And he has to carry the film himself, a lot of it. He's talking to himself throughout, you know, keeping the diaries, which is a great device to explain why is he talking to himself. I mean, even if you didn't keep mission diaries, you're alone on a planet, but you would talk to yourself. Of course you would.
Yeah. If I'm alone in a room for 10 minutes, I start talking to myself.
Yeah,
so.
I talk to myself all the time. Although I can say I'm talking to the cat. I mean, he's not listening, so.
No, he's very rarely listening to anything. But yeah, I totally get it. I would not need that explained to me. He's definitely just trying to stay alive, man. He's doing the best he can. He definitely does. Well, we're coming up on 4 minutes and 30 seconds left in this lightning round. So that's a good time to ask you, who is the MVP of The Martian?
I'm going to go for the non-obvious one. I'll just give it to Donald Glover for his very small role where he's just hilarious in every minute of screen time he's in.
I'll totally back that up. He is fantastic in this. I love all of his scenes. He is great. I mean, it's really easy to just say Matt Damon's the MVP for all of the reasons that you just said. He is definitely holding up this movie and carrying it on his back, and he's doing a great job. I'll toss out something for Ridley Scott, too. Like, he did a great job on this movie. Is this, like, really his last great movie? Everything since then has been kind of eh, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't actually seen his movie since this one, I don't think.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, one of the Alien movies was after this, wasn't it? Probably.
Oh, I think so.
Like Covenant, I think, was after this.
I think so. Oh, I don't like that one.
I haven't seen Napoleon or whatever else he's done. Gladiator 2, haven't seen it. So.
No, I have no interest in seeing that.
No, I didn't like Gladiator 1, so I'm not watching Gladiator 2. So there's no point.
You've even less interest in seeing that. Yeah, but this was a financial success, an award show success. This was a high watermark for Ridley Scott. And deservedly so.
Yeah, and it means that Andy Weir's other books will get adapted, or at least one of them. I don't know if he's written any more, but there's definitely one more.
No, he did. I think they are adapting another one. Yeah, he is. I remember reading this book back when it was still just like a free chapter by chapter thing that he was putting out because he didn't have a book deal yet.
Okay.
Yeah, he and all of the science he could back up, which is amazing.
Well, there's things like Mars doesn't have enough atmosphere for those big dust storms that they have. And so there's a bit of creative license done there to create extra jeopardy because there's no air. So how can there be a storm?
Wind blow? Yeah. That is a good point. But otherwise, I think all of the survival science is accurate, which is amazing.
Yeah.
At least we know.
Yeah.
Like you said.
And they missed one line of the end where he says, if I ever see another potato for as long as I live or whatever. He doesn't say it. I was expecting it. Like, I never want to eat them ever again.
I never want another potato. Yeah. Like at the end when he's a professor, he's sitting there with a cup of coffee. But I'm like, oh, he should have had a potato. Talking to a group of university kids. Well, we're coming up on 1 minute and 40 seconds left in your lightning round. So I think I know the answer to this one. Does The Martian deserve a full episode in 10 years?
I think so. Yeah, I think there'll be plenty to talk about. And I wonder if it'll still be an outlier in terms of positive blockbusters. Because this is a blockbuster. Like it's very high budget and, you know, it tries to appeal to as many people as possible, I think. I think that it has wide appeal, and it will be interesting to see in 10 years that we've moved into a more positive, you know, tonal space with movies, or if we're still in this, let's make everything dark and bleak.
Yeah. I mean, this movie grossed over $630 million worldwide. That feels insane to me right now.
Yeah.
The fact that this movie made that much money.
Yeah, Project Hail Mary probably isn't going to... It depends how good it is, but I just don't think we're in that place where the movies are making that much money. Because people wait for them to turn up on streaming in 5 minutes, so why would you bother buying a cinema ticket?
No, why would you? It's an incredibly different landscape right now than it was just 10 short years ago.
Maybe we'll have actually been to Mars with people in the next 10 years.
That's also very true, considering 10 years, a whole lot can change. Well, 10 seconds left. Any final thoughts?
Nope, just that it's great. Yeah.
Yay. Well, I can't believe it. See, and you didn't think it was possible.
No, well, I can be reined in sometimes, but...
Well, that ends, I think... You would want to do full episodes for both these because I know you have a lot more to say.
Yes.
And at some point, 10 years, we have a date, I guess.
10 years, jeez.
Yep.
You can imagine what life will be in 10 years.
This show certainly makes you think about time in a very interesting way. I will say that. Well, congratulations on surviving the lightning round.
Wasn't as bad as I expected.
See? See? You have to trust me. Everything's going to be fine. If anyone wants to continue the conversation with you, where can they find you online?
Mostly you can find me on Neil Before Blog. So that's neilbeforeblog.co.uk. You can find out on all the socials under Neil Before Blog, Facebook, Twitter, Blue Sky. There's a Discord as well that you can find links to just through neilbeforeblog.co.uk. I review nerdy stuff. So I will probably be reviewing Starfleet Academy next year when it comes on. And there's an attached podcast where discuss nerdy stuff long form as well under Neil Before Pod, so you can listen to that, where there's a monthly news podcast, interviews and various other shenanigans that we get up to. On the Film Stories Podcast Network, I am on one of the co-captains of We Are Starfleet, which is one of the Star Trek podcasts around there, so you can hear me on there.
Yay. Okay, and now the only thing that's left after this fantastic lightning round is to say thank you so much to Andy Williams and to you, Craig McKenzie, and to everyone who has tuned in. We very much hope you've enjoyed the show, and if you have, please subscribe to Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review wherever you can. While you're here, you should check out the show notes. You'll find links to all the things we're doing, as well as a link to the Discord where you can come and have a chat with us. And thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.